Got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Folta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here as always. Kevin, what's going on? How are you?
Well, everything's just great. I mean, it's middle of summer. We're getting the fun summer rain pattern down here in Florida, which is fantastic. And just, you know, living the dream, getting to teach horticulture during the day and do horticulture at night and on weekends.
That's great. I was just telling Kevin that I'm really jealous of his residence in rural Florida because I'm in a big California city and it's dry and hot and crowded. And as I get older, the more the call of nature comes to me.
So, yeah, well, you guys have been especially hot, haven't you?
It comes and goes. So we get like week-long heat waves where it's 106 or something. And normally that wouldn't be a crisis, but we're also in a drought. So there's limited water in California, and we're too busy building trains that don't go anywhere to do anything about it. So
that's right. And then diverting it from agriculture, which is really unfortunate. And there's a lot of people should get up to speed on what's happening in California agriculture with the drought. Maybe we could talk about it here next week, but it's extremely significant.
Yeah, absolutely. And always another factor is the environmental groups that won't let us build any dams or any pipelines, and they don't like desalination plants. They don't like anything. They don't like technology, as we've discussed multiple times. But
yeah, no, they're really important because there actually is the Clackamas River in the northern part of the state comes out of Oregon, and you can't use any water out of it at this point, because they're protecting the forage for a rare sucker up in the lake that feeds the river system. But the river system has been the irrigation for farmers on that plot of land forever. After World War II, a huge number of farmers came into that area and were all given land. You know, thanks for your service, here, start over. And now they're finding themselves, these families, years later, not having water to use what the ground was traditionally for. So it's a really, really amazing story. And maybe we'll talk about it sometime.
Yeah, we should. And I think Kevin Folta should be our governor instead of Gavin Newsom, because he seems to get the problem.
I'm a little busy. I don't live there. As long as I can do it from Florida, I can do it.
Do it via Zoom. Anyway, let's jump into our stories and I'll stop babbling. So first up, cell-based breast milk for mothers and babies inches toward reality. Next, Dr. Joseph Mercola's war on mainstream medicine. His take on the pandemic is a lucrative conspiratorial dream. And finally, the mRNA revolution that unleashed COVID vaccines is just the beginning. mRNA technology will be a part of medicine and drug research for decades to come. So Kevin, first up, this is, I found this particularly interesting given my circumstances, but tell us about this first story.
Well, that's right, because you won't be a big milk producer, so you can. but this is an important point. There are a lot of reasons why women are unable to breastfeed. So the ability to produce milk is something unique to mammals, but even more so the female entities of the mammals. And there's a lot of reasons why it just doesn't happen. It's an extremely exquisitely complicated process that depends on hormones and tissues and everything, nutrition, everything working just right. And so there's a lot of things that can happen that can prevent a lactation from happening properly. And they can be as simple as, you know, blocked milk ducts, other issues. But also problems with like the baby just not connecting correctly, not being able to draw milk out, or maybe the mother has pain associated with it. So there's a lot of reasons why it doesn't necessarily work. Well, there's a company in California that's come up with a solution, and the product is actually called Oh, you know what? I just missed the, it's called BioMilk, BioMilq. And if it ends in a Q without a U, you know something cool's going on. So BioMilk is a artificial milk. But it's not artificial. It's indistinguishable from the real milk because it's produced in what they call cellular agriculture. They're growing the cells of the that line the epithelium of the compartments in the breast tissue. They're growing those cells in culture, providing them with all the things they need to grow, and then using the same hormone, prolactin, stimulant hormone prolactin, to generate the production of milk in a petri dish. And then those cells are harvested or the milk is pulled off somehow. I don't know. They don't talk about that. But it's essentially a way to make human breast milk outside of the body and then be able to provide human breast milk for the consumption of little, for the consumption by little humans.
Yeah. It's crazy what we can do with biology these days. One question that occurred to me as I was reading this, and they addressed it very briefly, but not in much detail, is how do you reproduce the macronutrient profile of breast milk? Because I know that the cell-based meat companies are having trouble with that. You know, they can more or less get something that resembles a steak by using cells from animals, right? But they can't, you know, you won't get the same kinds or amounts of fats and proteins that you get from a regular steak. So do you have any insight into how they're trying to address this with breast milk?
Well, you can come close, right? Because you're still producing the same types of compounds. It's a really complicated solution, breast milk is. And so you have to be able to think about what kind of nutrition is there for those cells in the first place, and what is the media type that helps them make the milk product, and milk with a Q. And the idea here is, you know, can you come up with something that is identical or as close to identical to the mother? And it's a really brilliant idea. It's a far cry from soy-based formula, which many mothers have to revert to if they're unable to feed themselves. And so it's a really important breakthrough that I think is kind of exciting.
Yeah, without a doubt. I think it's quite a ways off. They're still in like the very early stages. You know, it's beyond proof of concept because they can make it, but it's nowhere near being a commercialized product. And I think the plan, if I read this correctly, was to make milk for individual mothers, right? Because there's no like with cows, you're not just taking cells from a cow. I think the idea is to be, this is yours for your baby. Is that along the lines of what's happening?
That's right. That you could actually be able to customize mother's milk for a child from the mother in the absence of the mother, or in the absence of the mother. And they think this is a lot of roles for potentially for foster children, other children which find themselves, you know, without the mother. You know, there's a lot of possibilities. So it's a very, very interesting concept in a time when we're seeing more and more of these types of synthesized solutions to important food questions.
You know, one thing, and I hate to be even a little bit critical of something new like this, because this is really cool, but I noticed in the story, I don't know if the company did this themselves, but the story that we were talking about, they said that PFAS chemicals are commonly found in breast milk. And yeah, the implication is like, well, this is going to, you know, this is far safer. And I think that's a bit misleading because, and we've talked about this before, and I think what you've said is that, you know, detecting a chemical somewhere doesn't mean it's dangerous. And so to use something like that to promote this product is a little disingenuous. And I see like impossible for all the good they do that. So it is Beyond Meat. You know, they say things about animal agriculture that aren't really correct because they're trying to sell their product. I get that part, but it's always kind of bothered me that they're like, we love genetic engineering. We're champions of science. And then they use these kind of bogus arguments sometimes. So yeah. I don't know.
No, you read my mind on this. You know, we neglected to say where this was found. This is from Green Queen website. BioMilk says it has successfully produced the world's first cell-cultured human breast milk by Sally Ho. So anyway, I've been forgetting the titles all the time lately. But going back to what you're saying, It is really disingenuous, and it has a potential to backfire. That when you say our product is safer because they've identified P PFAS in breast milk. So PFAS is the one of the chemicals which is associated with Teflon production, that whole thing. It is, you know, Scotchgard, the original Scotchgard. This is one of those chemicals, and it is persistent. It never goes away. And you can detect it at very small levels in rivers. You can detect it pretty much everywhere, but you can detect it in parts per trillion. So it's not biologically relevant, but you can find it. And it's just because we're really good at finding molecules that are almost not there. A trillion, part per trillion, is like a second since before the birth of Christ. I mean, this is, I'm serious. It's like 2,300 years or something. 1 second in 2,300 years. So it's almost not there. Yet when you give an expectant mother or a mother with a new child a non-zero number for a chemical that's been associated with cancer and other types of disease, it does raise their eyebrows.
Well, now one question, and I could be wrong on this, but assuming the women who make use of this technology, they've probably been exposed to PFAS chemicals in the past. So wouldn't the cells that are being used to produce the milk, even if it's in the lab, wouldn't those potentially have the same concerning chemicals in them? Or could they purify it before they produce it? I'm just curious.
No, it's a good question. I think that there are levels that are likely there, but as you, you know, add nutrient back in and remove, you know, things that are resident, you know, resident chemistry of the cells, you probably thin it out pretty good. And as long as it's not coming in with your nutrient inputs, then you probably don't have to worry about that. So I think that there's, you know, it is really, you know, levels of these things are so small, and I really wish they didn't go there.
Yeah. Yeah. And just the final thought. So the American Chemical Society published a study just last month in May, 2021, and they basically said the same thing. They're like, we're detecting this everywhere, but we don't have evidence that it causes any harm, you know, and they're overly conservative. And they say, you know, maybe there's some effect. We just haven't found it yet. And I think people have a tendency to interpret a conservative analysis like that as they're saying there probably is evidence. We just haven't found it. So I think that's an important qualification.
That's right.
All right. So speaking of people who are not conservative in their analysis, Dr. Joseph Mercola, what's going on with this
guy? Oh, boy. So this is, I know. This one is really important because Mercola, you know, he's an unsinkable rubber ducky. And this is a guy who because every time he gets pushed under, he pops back up. And he's had a number of things happen over the years with products he's endorsed or sold that have gotten him in hot water, but he's, you know, valued at over $100 million. So there's not a whole lot you can do to change the trajectory of his empire. But Mercola, he, now has moved into publishing books about COVID-19. And this is a report by Jonathan Jari. Jonathan, you know, from the McGill University Office of Science and Society, working with Joe Schwartz. And this was published in Genetic Literacy Project. And the important part of this particular article is that it reminds us that you know, Mercola is, by the look of this book, is not interested necessarily in the facts and the evidence, is excited to peddle a conspiracy, and in the end, it's all about selling a book. And he wrote this book with Ronnie Cummins, the good, with a foreword by John F. Kennedy Jr. So there you have that's quite a trifecta. Yeah, that's quite the trifecta of pseudoscience. And it also reaffirms the relationship between Cummins and Mercola, which we always knew was pretty solid. Ronnie Cummins runs the website Organic Consumers Association, which has very little to do with organic farming, is really just an anti-biotechnology site. So anyway, the idea with Mercola's book is it's called The Truth About COVID-19, Exposing the Great Reset, Lockdowns, Vaccine Passports, and the New Normal, Why We Must Unite in a Global Movement for Health and Freedom, currently trending as number one in political freedom category. So, yeah, I know. And I guess it's not a long book, but the basic idea is that they go with the idea that this was engineered in the laboratory, that it escaped, and that right now it's really just part of a cabal, a international movement to sequester all of the world's wealth in the hands of very few. And that, you know, that none of the vaccines are necessary, the tests aren't necessary, that all of it is just a big scam. And that apparently, according to Jari, is the gist of the book.
So there's so much to talk about here, so much to get into. I think the most important thing that I would hope people walk away with is that there are real concerns that need to be addressed about how we handle pandemics in the future. You know, we've talked about some of them, but one of my favorites is politicians that flouted their own stay-at-home orders. You know, they would give these addresses on TV and they'd say, you better stay home, Sonny, you follow the science. You know, and the next day they're out with their buddies at some fancy restaurant that no one else could afford and that they're not allowed to go to anyway. And they're having, you know, some fancy French dinner, like our governor again, you know? So there's real complaints that are totally justified. And then there's examples of some events being called super spreader events, while other events were like, well, just be careful if you go, wear a mask, you know? And that to me is frankly outrageous. And so all that to say, you can criticize that without going, it's a bioweapon, the Chinese made it, and they're trying to make you a communist. Like, if anything, that makes it harder to address the real issues because it turns it into a cartoon, you know?
Yeah, that's really the problem. Is he does have already a substantial listenership and readership and folks who follow his guidance, and so this really is just a big effort to expand his empire. He also laces in with the book, you know, all the things where, you know, here's the things modern medicine doesn't want you to know. And apparently says that quercetin, which is a natural plant compound, is a effective preventative. And he doesn't show any data for this. He links to a paper that made computer predictions about structures of molecules and what might work. And yet he recommends this and puts this into the book, you know, as, again, as part of the scam, right? And what's really funny, though, is that here he will recommend a compound with no good evidence of function against the virus, but then will denounce vaccination, which has been showing great effects against the virus. It just shows that this is completely upside down.
Yeah, yeah. Like the vaccine clinical trials had thousands upon thousands of people in them. And then, of course, we have all the real-world data and subsequent studies have been done. And the interesting thing here for me is that people like Mercola and Cummins, they will live and die by the VAERS database, which is the federal system that is used to report vaccine adverse events to, so the FDA and the CDC can investigate it. So this is totally unverified, self-reported data, and the agencies have to investigate it to make sure that it's legitimate. And a lot of times they can't because there's not enough information. But Mercola will cite that and say, look at all of these terrible reactions to the vaccines. And then he will dismiss the clinical trials because you can't trust Pfizer because that's big pharma. You know what I'm saying? So it's a consistent theme of citing bad data when you have way better research available. It drives me insane.
Oh, yeah. And then what's worse is that this brings in so much money and that he has constructed just such a massive empire from this kind of dubious work. And when you look at the list of places that he's donated to, he's donated like $3 million to the National Vaccine Information Center, which is like the place that has the crank opinions on vaccines and perpetuates them through very classy looking websites. He donates a fortune to the Organic Consumers Association, who donates to USRTK, who goes after university researchers for telling the truth about science. And so this is where, you know, the wheels start coming off. What's worse is that the Center for Countering Digital Hate reported that Mercola was one of the 12 dirty dozen social media personalities who had spread more than 66% of the false vaccine information. So Mercola is spreading false information. He's giving out lots of money. And then, according to that report, accepted or took and applied for over $600,000 in PPP money from the government. So he is taking your taxpayer money and then using it to finance organizations that are working against public health efforts. I mean, this is really bad stuff.
Yeah. Hey, really quick, if you guys want to learn more about Mercola, if you just type in anti-GMO advocacy funding tracker, you'll find an investigation that the GLP did and launched just last year. And we have a page on Mercola. And specifically, he has a foundation. It's called the Natural Health Research Foundation. It doesn't have a website. You can just find tax forms online. And it just exists for him to funnel money to Organic Consumers Association. And then they turn around and they promote his work. And they say, check out this article by Mercola. And here's some natural substances that will help you, you know, beat cancer or whatever. So it drives traffic to his website. And it's like a little, it's a little party that they all got going on, you know, and it's like, I think the total was like $3 million to OCA since 2013. You know, it's an absurd amount of money from one guy.
But this ties in with your article with John Entine and Genetic Literacy Project about disinformation feedback loops. And you see this more and more common, that you have folks like Mercola financing OCA, who writes about how a supplement that Mercola sells has benefit, and don't trust the scientists who say otherwise. And then they pay USRTK to write, well, the scientists who are criticizing Mercola's compound are all corrupt liars. So they build these articles within their own silo that, and then cite each other. And it looks like independent sources when really they're all connected at the wallet. And when you, and what's even worse is sometimes they will cite work in some entity associated with them, whether it's the guy or the woman, I'm not going to say their names, who have worked for legitimate news or outlets or have published in legitimate outlets. They'll say, well, according to Reuters or according or according to the Progressive, and these are legitimate sources who have given the stage to a bad actor. And they won't name the bad actor because everybody knows the bad actor is a bad actor and is a bad actor when you Google their name. But they'll use legitimate news sources to put a halo on their lousy claims. And it's all this intricate feedback loop of bad information.
Yeah, Kevin, even the New England Journal of Medicine says glyphosate causes cancer, you know?
don't get me started. You know, but this is a great example. It is so amazing that this kind of thing exists, but the good news is that it's been illuminated and over again that these are all interconnected disinformation networks. And the more that we talk about it and the more people do, you know, look at it, the more amazing it gets. And maybe just having these discussions will help insulate others from falling for something.
Yes. Oh, and a final thing. The foundation of Mercola's argument is this Event 201 exercise that was at Johns Hopkins University several years ago now. But I wrote a story about it for the American Council on Science and Health, and we talked about it on this podcast. And they were trying to spin the fact that you had like wealthy nonprofit groups and you had government agencies trying to prepare for a pandemic. And they spun that as, look, they knew it was coming. It's like, no, they didn't know it was coming. They're saying, we need to get medicines from here to there, and we need to get PPE from there to here, that kind of thing, you know? So they're just trying to prepare for it. And if they didn't do that and this thing happened, and of course the response, you know, was insufficient in many ways, but if they did no preparation, then these same schmucks would be saying, they didn't do anything, you know, this is outrageous, you know? So it's a, you know, heads I win, tails you lose kind of situation.
Yeah, the next pandemic is always coming. I mean, you know, until it's here or behind you, it's always in the future and you don't know what it is. And so you got to prepare for it. And I think that that's one of the things we've really learned from this exercise the last year and a half is that it's going to take a lot more to prepare for the next one of these things, especially since 50% of the nation thinks it's a joke. And if the next one comes along and has significantly more mortality or transmissibility, and those are the signals we're getting up front, you know, something like MERS, you will see a lot of people just disregarding everything. So we need a good dose of education and conditioning long before that next one gets here, you know, let alone PPE and distribution channels.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, something slightly more positive than that is the mRNA biotechnology revolution, Kevin. So tell us about this.
I made that nice like sound because this is I can't tell you how happy this makes me, because growing up as a molecular biologist since I was a little kid, mRNA has been in my lexicon, and the fact that I'm seeing this showing up everywhere, and I see people talking about mRNA, you know, I go to the little dumpy hillbilly bar down the street here and they're talking about mRNA, you know, and it's like, yes, you know, it's, I mean, when never thought I'd see the day. So this is a really exciting thing for me. But what's really cool about this is that really the first mRNA-based therapeutics, the idea really started in 1989 when you could inject the mRNA. So mRNA is a copy of the genetic blueprint in DNA, only for one gene. So DNA is the master blueprint for all the genes. mRNA is a little copy of that, a transient little copy. Think of it that if the DNA in the center of the nucleus is the hard drive, that this is a USB drive, small, transient, contains only a subset of the information of the whole drive. So this is why mRNA works. mRNA, back then, 1989, they took the mRNA that encoded the enzyme that made firefly luciferase, so which is the enzyme which does some catalytic events to cause the yellow glow. And if you injected that with the appropriate reagents under the skin of a rat, you could create these glowing lesions. So what it said was the cells were taking up that little molecular hard drive and using that information to synthesize the information on it. I neglected to mention the name of the article. It was the mRNA Biotechnology Revolution Unleashed by the COVID Vaccine Breakthroughs is Just Beginning. And this is by Maggie Fox at CNN. And what she goes through is takes this mRNA technology that started way back in 89 talks about some of its future applications. And the one thing I just wanted to mention really quickly is Dr. Catalin Carrico, who never gets the credit she deserves, who had these ideas back in the early 90s, late 80s, of injecting the mRNA and letting the cell make the protein that would be the antigen. And she worked through the hard parts with a guy, I don't know his first name, is Weissman at Penn State. And all of this came together, in the 2000s and really started to be moved in towards vaccine production in the 2010s. And a number of companies started working in this area. So there's a lot of players in the space. Coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2 is the big success story.
We talked about this months ago now, but can you just refresh people's memory? Because once the genome of SARS-CoV-2 was released, the basic elements of the vaccine were developed within weeks. And I think that illustrates just how powerful this technology could be in a different context. So tell us a little bit about that, just as a recap.
Yeah, well, that's really important, is that once you have the sequence of a new thread, you can now develop an mRNA vaccine against it. That is because normal vaccines come from the protein itself, which would mean you would have to isolate that protein, develop protocols for making more of that, or isolate that virus. You would have to develop protocols to make more of that virus, to purify antigenic proteins, to test to make sure that proteins didn't cause other antigenic effects or what they call enhancement. There's a whole bunch of different things that you have to worry about when you're using a traditional virus-based or protein, inactivated virus or protein-based vaccine. mRNA, you don't have to worry about that nearly as much because it encodes one antigen rather than the handful of antigens that could come through a virus-based vaccine. So this is a really great idea for being able to respond to a new threat fast. And history will show this was a monumental example of what we can do in science when we really want to get it done.
Yeah, it really is incredible. And the number of therapies they're working on, it's just, it's kind of staggering. You know, I don't mean to be such a fanboy, but it is really cool. And one that stands out to me is a universal flu vaccine. So I think the idea would be you take the blueprint, as you put it, for some part of the flu virus that doesn't mutate every season. And then you put that in the vaccine. And then that becomes the thing that protects you from a wide variety of flu strains. Is that basically how that would work?
That's right. There's okay. Different features of flu vaccines of the influenza virus, influenza A, such as a stalk protein and some other proteins that where you could design a universal epitope or universal, it could serve as a universal signature for immune reaction. I'll lose my jargon there. and those have been targets for years, but they don't work really well through protein intermediates, and maybe mRNA is the way to go.
Very, very cool. Now, there's some other ones they're working on. I mean, they're talking about, we've talked about cancer vaccines, but they're talking about doing customized cancer vaccines this way. They're talking about a potential shot for HIV. There's all kinds of stuff. So can you maybe go through a couple of the ones that stuck out to you?
Yeah, some of the really important ones are the respiratory syncytial virus, which this is a disease that affects children and the elderly. And it causes a significant number of deaths every year in children and in old folks, but it was very difficult to design a good vaccine against this. And this was an example of every vaccine they would generate caused this enhancement effect, meaning it caused an immune response that later when the virus came along made a led to a kind of a critical immune response. And excited the immune system a little too much and led to problems. So this same approach with mRNA looks much better. There's ones against cancers, targeting specific genes, which we know are important in cell replication, angiogenesis, things like that. There's a lot of interesting ones that are there. And let me go back and de-jargonize that again, that are necessary for blood supply to new tumor tissue. So they're even talked about in this article, sickle cell disease, which I don't know exactly how well that would work. I have to look at that one. That's new to me. But the one that is really old to me is cystic fibrosis. And cystic fibrosis is caused by a defect in a gene called the cystic fibrosis transmembrane conductance regulator. And so narcissistic fibrosis is when you get it. I made a mistake there. This is kind of funny. Narcissistic fibrosis. Cystic fibrosis, it causes a breakdown in the epithelium of the lungs. So the cells that line the lungs don't do their job exactly right. And it's a very simple mutation that causes it. And to be able to deliver the correct gene in a nebulized form, so being able to just take the puffer and breathe it in, and have those cells treated with that new copy of the gene, that maybe it could help limit the problems that come from accumulation of excess mucus during cystic fibrosis. So that seems to be a real promising one, and one I get pretty excited about.
It's very, very cool stuff. You know, not to be a fanboy, but it's cool. This is what science is about. One thing that just occurred to me, there's this guy, he's been bantered about by the anti-vaccine crowd. His name's Dr. Robert Malone, and they're pitching him as one of the inventors of mRNA vaccines, and he's been very critical of the COVID shots. Are you familiar with this at all?
No, I don't know him at all.
Okay, well, maybe we'll talk about it another day, but I'm just curious because this is like one of their hostile witness kind of people. They're like, look, even the guy that made it doesn't like it. I'm like, that sounds kind of weird, so. Anyways,
yeah, technology's got that. You know, that's the problem.
Yeah. And they do that with the anti-GMO thing too. They're like, former Monsanto scientist tells all. And then you see what he says and it's just fluff, but you know, whatever. Who are you following on Twitter this week, Kevin?
Yeah. So I'd recommend following the McGill University of Science and Society. So they're at McGill, MCGILL, SOS. And there you can read work by Jonathan Jari, the guy who we talked about at the beginning. Also links to his other podcast, Body of Evidence, and always the work by Dr. I almost said Joe Mercola. Oh my gosh. Dr. Joe Schwartz. He is as much as a hero as Mercola is the zero, and definitely worth a follow.
Yes, absolutely. Well, let me recommend, I've been going extra nerdy with my recommendations these last few weeks, but who cares? It's a science podcast. So I'm going to recommend people follow Trevor Charles. He is a chemist. Yeah. He does a lot of work with different pesticides and their impact on soil. He's been really helpful to me with some of my stories about glyphosate, but he is at Trevor Charles, microbiologist, excuse me, at yeah. Oh, what school is he at?
University of Waterloo.
That's right. Yeah. Anyways,
and a really, really great guy. And I got to meet him in person a few times, and I always really enjoyed the time with him. He's a super nice guy and also very active on social media. So that's a great recommendation.
Yeah. There was one time I was asking him about something about how much glyphosate ends up in soil. And see, he was on the train and he was doing the math on the train as I was asking him questions on Twitter, you know, so he's great. He's great. He'll take time out of his busy schedule to talk to you. So yeah, absolutely follow him. And we will leave it there for the week. Follow us as well at Cam J English, at Kevin Folta. Podcast is on iTunes and Spotify. Retweet it, like it, write us a good review. And follow us at the Genetic Literacy Project as well. Thank you guys so much, and we will see you next week.